One of the things that I've noted about looking at the history of Lubrizol is that there was always a large percentage of the employees engaged in research, probably more so than most other companies.
I think that was true.
What was the company thinking in terms of having that situation?
Well, the number one man there, founders, there were six founders, but the one man who did most all of the direction of the company's policies and what have you was Calvin Smith. And he was a research person himself. He was a chemical engineer. And his thinking, I'm sure, he was a very close friend of mine. I had a lot to do with him. Was the only way we're going to get ahead in this business is to do a lot of research, bring out a lot of compounds, and pick those that'll work, and many of them won't. And I think that was the policy that he set and made it succeed.
In the early days, how much research was, I'm going to put it under the heading trial and error, and as opposed to a theoretical background or more of an understanding of how these additives are functioning?
I don't know if I can answer that with any degree of certainty. We did both kinds of things. I know we would try things that looked like out of the world, you know, probably wouldn't work and so forth, and sometimes they would. This Bill LeSueur that I mentioned, he came up with an idea that nobody else had had before, and putting dispersions in the oil to help solubilize the other products and so forth. And that turned out to be a tremendous product, I mean, line of products before it got through. They were very useful in keeping all the stuff soluble and dispersed in the oils and so forth, and he got a number of patents on that simple idea. So some of it was, you know, thinking ahead, theoretical, but we followed leads that we'd find in certain products that weren't quite good enough. Maybe if we do this to it, it'd be better. And that sort of stuff. A lot of sulfur compounds, a lot of phosphorus compounds. The dispersants were nitrogen esters and complicated esters with nitrogens in them, amines and amides.
Can you tell me more about Calvin Smith and what kind of person was he to work for?
Well, he was, to me, he was one of the brightest brains I've ever met. And he, in effect, ran that company. But, unfortunately, except for me, everybody else was scared of him. I mean that. There was a Canadian that worked there, headed up a pilot plant. Tremendous fellow. He told me once that every time he called into Calvin Smith's office, sits down in front of his desk and his toes curl up in his shoes. The guy scared people, but he was the most gentlemanly person I've ever met. Very polite, very quiet, very... I can't understand why people were scared of him, but most of them were. His secretary once lost her voice, and she'd been around there quite a while. Well, that's an interesting story. His secretary just couldn't talk, and he tried everything to get her back. There wasn't anything wrong. Her doctors looked there, nothing wrong, just mentally or something. Couldn't talk. One day he came to me and he said, the secretary's name was Anyway, he came to my office and said, would you call this gal in and talk with her? Of course, she hadn't talked for a week or 10 days. I said, well, what do you want me to say? I said, just whatever you want. So I called her in, sat down, and I talked with her a while. I don't know what I said for sure. I just idle chatter. And then I finally made some statement, and I said her name was Ethel, or I forget. I said, do you agree with that? She said, yes, I do. First word she'd said for 10 days. And from there on, I talked with her, and she talked back, and everything was okay. Well, Kelvin was very happy about this, and one day I asked him, well, how come you sent her in to talk with me? And he said to me, and I'm not even sure what he meant, he says, you have a sixth sense about people. That's why. Whatever that means. But he and I were very close friends, and many people were jealous of me because he and I would go out to lunch almost every day to talk over things. He told me all the problems that the company was having, and we discussed them, and of course, I think that's why I got the topic.
Well, he must have had a great deal of confidence in you then to be able to pick you out as the person he would confide in and talk to that much.
Well, I've never quite understood it, but sorry. I got a throat that's bothering me today. He knew that people were afraid of him. And he knew that none of them were afraid of me. And that was true. I got along with everybody, no problems. And I ran an operation there that if some officer of the company made a mistake, they'd come over and talk to me about it. In manufacturing. Vice President, come on, I goofed up here today. And no, they weren't afraid to tell me. And we'd talk about it, and I'd say, well, you won't do that again. No, I don't see. So I think that's part of it, that maybe I had a sixth sense about me, whatever that means. And I had, they're all friends of mine. It was just like a big family. Except for Calvin.
Yes, he was what? One of three brothers?
Yes.
And there was another brother who preceded him. Is that correct?
Yes, the Kent Smith was the oldest of the three brothers. And he was, I guess he was chairman or something of the board for a while there. And I don't think Calvin ever took the job as chairman of the board. He just ignored that. And then Vincent, the third brother, he really had his own business and didn't do a lot with Liversall, except he was a member of the board and about it.
One of the things that intrigued me was early on, I know there was a connection with their father and Herbert Dow.
Yeah.
And that there were several attempts made to get Dow Chemical interested in making some of these things, but Dow never expressed any interest in doing that. Is that correct?
I don't know that. I'm not sure. I know that the Smith brothers' father was a key individual in establishing the Dow Chemical Company, and I'm sure that it could very well happen that since he was involved in that they might have requested some work for Dow, or Dow may have, I don't know, whatever. I've never really had a whole lot of knowledge about that operation there. or how it came about.
While you were directing research, and then, well, when you got into research and development, how comfortable did you feel with taking over the development aspects and setting up manufacturing?
No problems.
Okay.
I knew everybody. It was a small company. And that's one of the reasons I said I wasn't going to work for a big company. I knew everybody worked for Lubrizol, and I was friendly with them. And I don't believe there was more than 200 or I don't know how many there were when I was put into the job. It wasn't very many people. It grew rapidly after that, but I think at one time there was about 400 in there. I may have been executive VP or something at that time.
But the 50s was, is that 50s, early 60s when the foreign expansion took place as well, and were you involved in that?
The what's the expansion?
Foreign, going into foreign countries.
Oh, yeah. We had a vice president of manufacturing who was an engineer. And the first plant that we put out of the country was in France. And he was over there while that was built. He was the vice president of the corporation, very capable person on building structures and all that. And of course, he was also in charge of putting the Houston plant in. That was the second U.S. plant we put together. He was there when that was built. Roger Clapp was his name, and he's still living, a very good friend of mine. And we get together once in a while and talk about the old days.
That's great. But the research efforts stayed here in Wycliffe, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did you interact in the research area with the other plant locations? Did you help them in solving problems?
Well, I visited most all those plants at one time or another, and it turned out that they never did very much manufacturing. We had one in England and France, also finally in South Africa or somewhere, and Great Britain, and actually had one in Japan and Australia, all over. And our products that we sold, I can remember this figure, that 75% of them, while I was still there, were sold overseas. Only about 25% in the U.S. So we covered the whole area of the world. And we were, again, about the first people involved in that business. That's why we grew so much, so rapidly. A dog heard somebody at the bell.
The bell rang, yes. I read somewhere that you, when you became president in 73, and I guess you had already figured that Roger Clapp had picked you to take that position.
Yeah, he was in advance of me.
That you really disdained what you called the rituals of modern management.
Yeah.
And you just said you didn't believe in taking these courses for managing courses and so on, did you?
That's right. I didn't believe in it. I still think it's a waste of time. Well, maybe it's changed. No, I wouldn't send anybody to management schools. There was an article, there was some magazine came to interview the company in the 70s, And I can't think of the name of it. It was a business magazine. And they asked these kind of questions of me. And I told them, and I told them why. And they had that as a sub-headline in the article that was published. And then also, Les Coleman was at that time executive vice president. They went in to interview him. He had a book on his desk by Drucker, who was a management expert. And when this reporter came in, he says, "Geez, I better take this book off my desk. Masson might see it." Well, they put that in the magazine, in the article. And I got letters from all over the world. It was because it was an international magazine. And some of them said, "What an arcane title company you must operate." And many of them said, "I'd sure like to work for this company." But I thought that at that time, and I still think it's true, and I think it's beginning to be proved now, that management education is not really worth all it's cracked up to be. And the people that get out of Harvard, for example, think that, well, they're going to be the next president. You know, that doesn't work that way.
Well, your sixth sense for people, I think that's one of the keys, is the relationship you have with the people that work with you.
Could be. I don't know. I don't even know what a sixth sense is. I thought we only had five.
When I talked to Ray Boundy, who was research director at Dow for a number of years, he used the term accountable freedom.
Accountable freedom?
Freedom in dealing with his people. In other words, they were accountable, yet they had flexibility to make decisions and do things and work on their own projects that would benefit the company. Mm-hmm. Would you say that kind of thing applied to your style also?
Yes, I think so, very much so. We had group leaders in the lab that had four or five or six of them working with them. They're supposed to take care of that group and get ideas, and it was freedom. And everybody that worked there, and I've talked with most of them, they say they just love that work. And nobody was upset about anything. It was like a big family, really. And that was part of the success, the reason for it, the success. People just loved working there.
That was one of my general questions, was how do you how do you nurture innovation? How do you get your people to be innovative and creative?
I don't know. I was always one to go out, even as president, go out and talk to the research people and ask how they're doing and what new ideas you got, and that sort of thing. Research was the main reason for Luber's all success, no question about it, in my mind. And so I spent a lot of time, after I was a top executive there, working with the research people. And I also, of course, went to meetings of manufacturing and all the others, but that was the most interesting to me. And I don't know how, whether I inspired them for any reason, but they knew that if they were successful, they'd be rewarded one way or another, and everybody'd be happy with them and so forth. So I don't really know any better answer than that.
As I understand it, the company had a, I'm going to call it a profit-sharing kind of situation from the early days. Is that correct?
Yeah. They sold, well, first of all, they had a, they put money away in a fund that was to be distributed eventually to people. And they went on the New York Stock Exchange in 1962. Prior to that, however, they sold stock based on a formula of some sort to what they called the key employees. And the first stock I was offered was 50 shares, and the price at that point, for the, according to the formula, was $75 a share. And that was when that was in 1943. And I had become a key employee since I was head of research. And I didn't have enough money to buy $75 times 50. And I bought 5 shares. I was able to scrape up enough money. But after that, I borrowed all the money I could from Cleveland Trust and 3% interest, and bought every stock that I was offered from there on, every share of stock. Because I thought I was foolish for not borrowing money to begin with. And I'd only been there less than a year the first time. So they, after that, the stock was put on the market, 62, so anybody could buy it. A lot of them did, including me. We had a program of stock options also. Roger Clapp and I decided one day, after we'd taken a lot of these options, that we weren't going to take any more from the other people do it, and we stopped having taken any further options. But he and I had enough and didn't need it.
One of the other things that we've touched on briefly is, and it was part of my general questions as well, was the scientific teamwork. Your people were the teamwork involved with your research group, as opposed to people operating individually. How would you describe that group result?
Well, as I mentioned, they had a group leader with maybe 4 or 5 working under him, and I would say they worked as a team, and every month or so we'd have research meetings where we discuss what's been going on, what progress has been made, and I would say that almost every research person there was aware of what each of the others were doing, and if they had an idea on this fellow's work, go talk to him. I mean, we all knew what everybody else was working on, pretty much. If we got a little bigger and bigger, that wasn't always true. But it was in the beginning, I think. And I think it was perfect teamwork to do it that way.
Well, the company had to respond to the changes in the industry, and there were certainly a lot of those changes.
Yeah.
In terms of the needs and the requirements. How did you keep aware of these changes?
Well, the military, during that war, set up specifications for the lubricants that they would buy from us or anybody else. And those specifications were pretty strict. They had to go through a whole series of tests. And at that point, the whole industry changed into these military specifications that anybody in the business would have to meet before they could sell products. And that means to companies outside the military. So those specs are still in effect, and they change all the time. So I think it was the military's need that caused that major change. And from there on in, we have one of the biggest mechanical test laboratories in the country at that time, and still do. We had to run a lot of engine tests, a lot of gear tests, and they were all set up initially by the U.S. military, and they're still. I don't know if the military is involved in it too much anymore, but that's the way it started. So we had to put in a lot of equipment to meet those specs at the beginning.
When you were CEO, I think was the time when the environmental concerns became more important than government regulations and that kind of thing. What were your experiences with that?
Well, we were there in Wycliffe, and some of the products we made didn't smell very good. So we had some complaints from neighbors around there. One woman particularly always after us. So we had to be careful about leaving any odors out in the air, and we did a good job, I think, in correcting that problem. And also, we were very careful about materials that would leave the laboratory. We would never put them out in a river or a ditch or anything like that. We had systems set up where they would be destroyed or burned up or whatever. We would never pollute anything, including the air. That was a policy, and we stuck with it.
So when the government started to regulate this, you were already in.
We had no problem. Except with this one woman in the neighborhood. And she wanted to give us a problem all the time.
How did you deal with her? Did you have to deal with her, or did somebody else?
No, personnel.
Is it still company policy to have such a high percentage of its employees in research?
Well, I think so. We're just putting in a new research lab, as a matter of fact, right now. And I don't know how many are in there now and what percentage of the total employee is, but it's high. And I hope it stays that way.